Welcome to the Best Science Medicine Podcast, BS without the BS.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the 384th episode of the Best Science Medicine Podcast. My name is James McCormack, and I'm a professor with the Faculty of Pharmaceutical Sciences at the University of British Columbia.
And I'm Mike Allen. I'm a family doctor and a professor at the University of Alberta.
And Mike, we have a special guest today. And
special.
Well, yeah, they're all special, but this is just more special, if you will. We have Tim Caulfield, who is a professor of law at the University of Alberta. And some of you may know him. I feel like I'm going to do a Simpson thing. He's written a really interesting, he publishes a ton, but he's written an interesting book called Is Gwyneth Paltrow Wrong About Everything? So that may be where some of you might know his name from. And he also does a lot of online media stuff. He does a TV show called A User's Guide to Cheating Death. And we had him at our Best Science Medicine course this year. And we wanted to invite him to talk about a variety of things. So welcome, Tim.
Well, thanks for having me, guys.
Yeah.
I'm really looking forward to it.
And one of the things, now, you're with the Faculty of Law, and maybe you could let the audience know why you're so passionate about the issues around health, for instance, given that you're a lawyer, and as we know, most lawyers don't care about those sorts of things. Just kidding.
that's right. Yeah. I don't feel like a lawyer anymore, if that counts for anything at all. I, as you can imagine, I often get that question, what's a lawyer doing this evidence-based healthcare stuff for? Well, you know, it's really because most of my career I've been looking at policy issues, and I became fascinated with what does the evidence say about a particular policy, you know, to justify a particular policy. And that kind of pulled me in, that kind of dragged me into this world of evidence-based medicine and or science-based healthcare. And I've become fascinated with it. And for most of my career, I've worked in big interdisciplinary teams, because I generally don't have the methodological skills to pull off a lot of the things that I'm interested in. So we've looked at, you know, what the evidence says about everything from genetic testing to, you know, stem cells. Now we're doing a big project on the microbiome, to alternative medicine, all of these things. And you know what? I really am passionate about it. I love it. And the other dimension to this is I have this allergic reaction to seeing nonsense in the popular press, you know, in popular culture. It just drives me nuts for some reason. And so that's the other thing. You know, I love digging into how things are presented in the popular sphere.
And I think we're kind of the same way, that we, anytime we see BS, we just kind of go, oh, you're kidding me. You know, it just drives you crazy and you want to delve into it. And that's kind of what Mike and I have done for quite a while. And a bit of just to make sure there's no conflict of interest, Tim and I have published on a couple of things. We've done some vitamin D stuff, as Mike and I have done some vitamin D stuff and so on. So so it's always been fun working with you. And so what we thought we'd do is talk a little bit about genetic testing and personalized medicine, because boy, is it ever big in the world today. And boy, does it probably not warrant the amount of press that it's getting. That's my take on it. So why don't you just sort of let us know what your sort of spin, if you will, is on this whole concept.
Yeah, I think you're right. Genetic testing, particularly direct-to-consumer genetic testing, is getting a huge amount of press. And it's interesting for me, because this has been around for a while. You know, really, these companies have been around for a long time, and I think 23andMe is probably the best known. This is a company in California affiliated with Google in a sort of a soft sense. And it's been around for a long time, it's taken off, though. It's really taken off in just the last couple of years. If you look at the numbers, there's been a massive growth since about 2016. Part of that's because there's an increased interest in ancestry testing, but I think also there's this increasing acceptance of the marketing that you getting this genetic information is going to help your healthcare, right? You're going to be able to take sort of preventative steps. So I think it's a really hot topic right now, this direct-to-consumer genetic testing. You're starting to see stories in the popular press about people using direct-to-consumer genetic testing for ancestry purposes, right? And there have been some stories about people finding out that their parents aren't who they think they are, which is really can be very disruptive. There have been stories about people finding out, you know, surprising things even about their health, right? So this is getting a lot of press. And I guess the big question is, is it worth it, right? Yeah. Is it really worth it?
And I think, I know, just looking at some of the information you have, you know, I think a lot of people feel that the, and I've had people say this to me, they said it to me 5 years ago, and it's still not true, is that we'll be walking around with a little card in our wallet, and we will hand it to our doctor, and apparently, Mike, you'll know what to do with that, because it'll have all of it.
I already do, James. I do.
You have a card, or you know what to do with it?
Your card should say, do not resuscitate.
Exactly. Thank you. That is such a kind thing to say.
You know, what episode are we on now?
This is 384, in case you weren't paying attention at the beginning of the podcast.
I've been waiting for 383 to say that.
I know.
And it's been a long wait.
Yes, I know. So other than, so Tim, I would love to do genetic testing on Mike, but, you know, he might not come out much higher than a baboon.
I've already sent mine off. I'm part collie. Nice. And also...
And I know, Tim, you're gonna let us know, you've actually sent your stuff off, but we'll maybe get to that in a bit about what you found. But why don't you keep going on, you know, this sort of pseudo-revolution, if you will, of personalized medicine, because it sounds incredibly sexy, because who wouldn't want everything to be personalized?
Yeah, you're right about that, this the revolutionary language, right, that's been attached to, you know, I've been following this my whole career. It's kind of interesting that the Human Genome Project kind of got started right when I got out of graduate school. It was, you know, getting started right when I, you know, first started my academic position. You know, I did a fellowship on this right when it was sort of all playing out. And it's this revolutionary language has always been there, right? Mm. And what I think is fascinating, you guys, is when it first started, the promise was that we were going to have gene therapies, right? We were going to have, you know, we're talking the early 90s, mid 90s, we were going to have gene therapies for everything. That didn't really pan out. So then the next revolution associated with genetics was going to be all these highly penetrant cancer genes, or I'll put it more broadly, highly predictive disease genes, right, that we were going to be able to use to predict future health, but also to take action. That didn't really pan out. And now we're kind of in the middle of the personalized medicine or precision medicine revolution, and that language is absolutely everywhere right now. You know, you have Francis Collins, who was the head of the Human Genome Project, now the head of the NIH, talking about it all the time, right? Mm-hmm. And he, what I think is fascinating, and it's important for our discussion today, is that he always frames it as if this is going to be empowering to the patients, right? Personalized medicine is empowering. That's a direct quote from Francis Collins. And you hear that all of the time. Even Barack Obama has said this, right? When, you know, he really gave personalized medicine a boost. He gave it both, you know, sort of as a cheerleader, but also financially from the federal government. And when he was sort of advocating for this in one of the State of the Union addresses, he talked about, you know, that personalized medicine will give us all access to the personalized information we need to keep ourselves and our families healthier. So that's a direct quote, right? Again, this empowerment idea, and the underlying message there, of course, is that personalized medicine, this genetic information, is going to allow you to live a healthier life, and also to allow doctors, right, to make more informed decisions, right? Mm-hmm. And that has really, really been the message from the start. There's this really famous, I don't know if you guys remember this, a famous lecture that was in the New England Journal of Medicine by Francis Collins, when he at that time was the head of the Human Genome Project. And in that piece, he talks about how genetic information is going to allow primary care physicians to have these teachable moments, right? So they're gonna have this is 1999, right? So they're gonna get this genetic information. They're gonna sit down with their patients, and they're gonna have this teachable moment, which is going to quote Francis Collins, lead to a lifelong change in health-related behavior, right? So that's what genetic information is gonna do. And he predicted this would happen by 2010, right? So of course, in 2010, it hadn't happened yet, right?
Well, I was gonna ask Mike, how many of these moments have you had?
Every day, buddy.
Oh, okay.
Every day. They're not based on genetics.
No.
There's lots of teachable moments in medicine. They're not based on genetics. And I think part of what you're hinting at here, Tim, is that we've been hearing this promise of just around the corner now is going to revolutionize medicine, not just for genetics. There's many other things that are going to revolutionize medicine. But there's a lot of things that have stayed the same, more than have revolutionized it, that's for sure. And this is one of those, this whole personalized medicine thing, you know, because our shared university is, it is putting this as one of its primary goals in the Faculty of Medicine, to invest in personalized medicine. And yet I cannot foresee a time, I can't see anything in primary care yet that's even signaling an opportunity to put this into action in family medicine or general practice, anything like that. I just can't, I haven't seen it yet.
Well, it's interesting you should say that, because personalized medicine, that idea has really been co-opted by this movement, right? Because, you know, I've talked to many primary care physicians. My wife is a primary care physician, as you know, and they all say, I've always done personalized medicine, right? You know, I find out what's going on in this individual's lives, these people's lives, and I try to make treatment decisions based on that information. That's personalized medicine. But it's really been co-opted by the genetics community. And I don't necessarily mean that in a bad way. I don't think there was any kind of malevolent intent in that. But it successfully did that. We did a study where we looked at hundreds and hundreds of popular representations of personalized medicine. And in the popular culture, personalized medicine and precision medicine means genetics, right? So this is really, when you talk about personalized medicine, that's how the public reads it, right? And you're correct. You know, how much of that is really translated, and we'll come to that in a bit, I guess, really translated in a meaningful way to the clinic. And, you know, I think that's open to question.
Yeah, and I, like I said, personalized medicine, and I was going to mention this more at the end, but it's really about, you know, doing exactly what Mike is saying, and I'm sure what your wife does, is individualizing it. And lo and behold, we could talk about, you know, low doses and shared decision making and all that sort of stuff. But you're right, it's being co-opted. So, yeah, well, you keep leading us down the path, though, of what's been going on and what evidence, even though it's probably minimal, that there is.
Well, I think it's, you know, this whole idea of empowerment is really important to hammer home, because you got to think, this is a huge cultural phenomenon, right? This personalized medicine phenomenon. There has been huge investment by governments in personalized medicine. As Mike said, our own institution is embracing the concept of personalized medicine and precision medicine. But when you're talking about chronic disease, right? When you're talking about, you know, the average Canadian, what you're really talking about, as Barack Obama said, and as Francis Collins said, giving people information in order to allow them to change their lives. What are your risks, right? So that's really at the core of a lot of the promise of personalized medicine. And that is at the core of the promise of direct-to-consumer genetic testing. When 23andMe first came to Canada in 2014, you know, that's what the CEO said, right? She said that this information that you can get personally online is going to allow you to, you know, make decisions about your health and lifestyle, right? That's going to make you live longer and live a healthier life. So this really, this personalized medicine thing, this personalization approach to life has really become a cultural phenomenon. As your listeners probably know, now you can get genetic testing for diet, right? There are all these different companies that are offering genetic testing to allow you to tailor your diet. There are skin creams that are allegedly tailored to your genetic information. You can go and send your DNA, and they'll find to a company, and they'll find you a genetic match for dating purposes, like to find you a partner based on your genetic information.
So wait a second, Tim. If that's true, then if there's a chance to find a better life partner, I think my wife would like to hear more about that. So could you tell us? Could you tell us
that's right.
Exactly how that works?
Yeah, that's right. I think of all people, had I known that I could precisely pick a mate, I would have taken a different life path. yeah, it's scientifically absurd. You know, and that's one of the fascinating things, is they're really leveraging, you know, I call it science exploitation, right? They're really leveraging the excitement around personalized medicine and all the science-iness of it in order to sell an absurd idea. And it sounds plausible, right? It sounds plausible. But of course, when you're talking about something that's, you know, infinitely complex, love, you're not going to have a genetic test that's going to, you know, solve that problem.
But you can get the appeal of it, though. You know, wouldn't it be nice if we could match all of these things? And that's, you know, even as you're talking about it, even though I'm a, you know, as much, I'm pretty evidence-based, and in my, there's a little part of my brain going, I wonder if that works, you know?
You're right. I think that's a really important point, because the other thing that they do is they always, you know, you look, go to these websites, they look entirely legitimate, and they always inject a little bit of real science, right? You know, your the genetics around how other people smell and things like that, right? That makes it seem like it could be legitimate, right? And of course, it's just not, and there's rarely any clinical trials to support it. Mm-hmm. Then they have these companies call that give you, do genetic testing for sports, right? And to find out your athletic abilities. And again, that sort of has an intuitive appeal, even though, again, there's not that much evidence to support it.
But it intuitively makes sense, because there's no doubt there's all of these things are, there's many genetic link, that not necessarily links, but people are genetically, some people are better genetically at sports. Now, obviously, you have to train and all that sort of stuff. Or people are, you know, more artistic. And there is clearly got to be some sort of a genetic reason for that. But whether or not we can map it out, that's the tricky part.
Yeah, you're right. All of these things, absolutely, there's genetics involved, right? Mm-hmm. But if we've learned anything from the Human Genome Project and all the incredible work that's going on, and by the way, I'm not against this research. I think a lot of exciting work is happening. Mm-hmm. If we've learned anything, it's the incredibly complex relationship between our genes and even disease traits, let alone complex human characteristics, right? Mm-hmm. So the relationship is just far too complex to make these kind of definitive statements, which you often get from these companies.
It's kind of like forecasting weather 7 years out.
Yeah. It is, yeah, you know, yeah. And you can, you know, that's a great analogy. And by the way, I'm stealing that from you. That's cool. that's a great analogy because, yeah, that's, you could do that, and you could rely on science, right? You could rely on, you know, air pressure. I don't know what the heck they would rely on. But you could kind of create a scientifically plausible path to that prediction, right? And that's kind of what's going on here. But layer on top of with humans, layer on top of all the other variables, and of course, socioeconomics, you know, the microbiome, epigenetics, all of these things that play a role. Even for something like sprinting, right, which seems very straightforward, it in fact is a very complex human trait. Absolutely, genetics plays a role. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. But can you predict what kind of athlete you're going to be? No. But there are companies that go even further. There's this company called MapMyGenes, which will tell you, it's marketed at parents to tell parents what the hidden talents of their kids are, right? So because knowledge is power, and you're going to be able to make decisions about their education and their career. And it sounds scientifically absurd, and it is scientifically absurd. But there are companies around the world doing this, and their parents, you know, taking it up. And there was a paper that came out not that long ago about how in China there's been a huge uptake in this testing by parents to find out what the hidden talents of their kids are, and then you can take your kid to what's been called a talent detection facility to find out what kind of traits they have and how you should be funneling their behavior. So yeah, you know, there are a lot of absurd things out there. You know, I've tried one that's called Venome, which is a genetic test to find out what kind of wine you're supposed to be drinking. There's a company that will give you a DNA match to find the right roommate, right? Can you imagine that? And there's even, of course, there's ones for dogs and for pets. So there's a lot of nonsense out there. We did a study, which has been submitted to publication, so this is still preliminary data, where we looked at 61 different direct-to-consumer companies, which we think were, you know, a good sampling of the market. And we were surprised. What we were looking for is what's being offered to the public. What promises are being made? You know, what are they marketing, right? And losing weight, disease prevention, improved training, increase your knowledge about your health, lifestyle improvement. These are the promises, right? Mm-hmm. And we shouldn't surprise us, because this goes back to the initial promise made by Francis Collins about empowerment, right? By Barack Obama about empowerment. This is the message that's being sent, and this is what the promise is.
And unfortunately, you know, and it's like anything else. Of course, you know, and I'm going to paraphrase, everyone wants to lose weight. No one wants disease. Everyone wants to be healthier. Everyone, you know, all these sorts of different things. And it's, you know, it really draws you in, just like anything else. Like it's marketing, you know, that's why people take statins to reduce your chance of heart attacks, or why we do eat healthier or try to eat healthier. We do more activity, and you know, we're all in search of the holy grail, if you will.
Yeah, you're right, and I think it's, you know, you almost can't emphasize this enough, right? I mean, that this information has been pounded into our brains for the last mm-hmm. 3 decades, right? This idea that genetics matters, that this information matters, right? This is a message that's been coming from governments, from research institutions, from the medical community, right? It's from mm-hmm. pop culture. It's absolutely everywhere, this idea that this information matters. But let's look at what's the reality here, guys.
Yeah, yeah.
Let's look what the science actually says, right? And I think it's important to remember. So the message is, by and large, right, that you need this genetic, direct-to-consumer genetic risk information because you're going to be able to change your behavior, right? That's the reality. That's the promise. And that promise makes sense, right? Because if we're going to tackle chronic disease, that's what we need to do, right? Now, I want to be clear here. We're talking about, in general, chronic disease. There are, of course, monogenetic diseases. So if you have the Huntington's disease gene, you're going to get Huntington's disease, right? Mm-hmm. There are cystic fibrosis, and there are all those, you know, a constellation of other monogenetic diseases, fairly rare, but obviously in that context, genetics means a lot. There are also a relatively short list of highly predictive cancer genes, BRCA1 and 2 being probably the best examples, right? But again, a relatively short list. What we're really talking about here, if you're talking about population health, is changing behavior. So you're trying to get people to, you know, exercise more, you know, eat a healthier diet, you know, stop bad habits like perhaps smoking and drinking too much alcohol, and perhaps adopt better screening behavior, which is a, you know, controversial topic in itself. We can come back to in a bit.
Yeah.
So the question is, and this is really the core of it, and it's amazing how simple this question really is, given all the noise around this. The question really is, does genetic risk information change people's behavior, right? That's the bottom line. You know, will it change? Will it cause your patients to change their behavior, right?
And even as you're talking, I'm thinking, you know, if it was literally as easy as letting a person know about the risk and they would just automatically go, oh, well, my goodness, what was I thinking? You know, and they would change. I mean, Mike, your job would be a lot easier.
Well, I'm just thinking, like, when you look at smoking packages, they pretty much now say smoke this and die.
Yeah, exactly.
and yet I don't see the packaging creating a lot of stoppage. Now, maybe genetics is going to be different. Maybe there's some cognitive piece that when people hear that it's genetics, it'll make a big difference. Anyhow, I'll be interested to hear what the answer is to that, Tim, because I, in my heart of hearts, I want to believe this is true.
Yeah, because, and like you're right, because it's, you know, for the number of people who smoke, I mean, I don't think there's anybody in the world that doesn't know that, like, smoking is bad for them. Like, it's not...
It's actually one of the things I bring up with people when I'm reminding them about their smoking. I'll say, have you heard... smoking is bad for you because I like to, you know, make things a little bit lighthearted, mm-hmm. but like then I remind them that this is the most important thing in your health that you're doing right now, that it's more important than anything I can do.
Yeah.
And so it's interesting to think that we would assume that this is going to be the thing that's going to change people's behavior.
Yeah, because no one goes, when you tell them that, you go, oh my goodness, I wish I would have known that. You know, and I'll stop smoking tomorrow. I mean, yeah. So anyway, keep going, Tim.
It does have incredible intuitive appeal, though, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, you know, this idea, if you find out what you're genetic risk for, it's going to cause you to smarten up, right? And I don't think, you know, we really need to emphasize how this has been a core part of the message of the entire personalized medicine precision medicine movement, right? So does that question, does genetic risk information change people's behavior? And what's fascinating, you guys, is we've known for a long time that the answer is No, it does not change our behavior. There's very little evidence. There's never been strong evidence that it changes behavior. So way even back in 2006, there was a systematic review that said few studies suggest that DNA risk information will change behavior, right? And what's interesting for me is that kind of information existed already before a lot of the personalized medicine hype started to blossom, right? There was another systematic review done a little bit later, systematic review. Again, genetic risk information does not change behavior. There was one in the New England Journal of Medicine, and this one's really interesting because it involved direct-to-consumer people that have bought genetic direct-to-consumer genetic testing kits. And once again, doesn't change behavior. And this shouldn't surprise us. As you guys have already highlighted, it's really, really hard to change people's behavior. If it was easy, we'd be doing it all the time, right? The example I like to use is the bathroom scale, right? You know, that's a number that people can look at every single day. It is correlated with health issues. And do people change their behavior? They might try, but it's extremely difficult to do it in any kind of sustained way. And just to hammer this point home, and I think it's important to hammer it home, there have been a lot of studies, as you can imagine, over the last couple of years, looking at does genetic risk information change our behavior. They've looked at it in the context of smoking, right? So if you're at increased risk for getting cancer as a result of your genetics, you think you might try harder to quit smoking. And they found the answer is no, it doesn't change behavior. They've done it with weight loss and found that it doesn't increase weight loss. And this one, this study, I think, is very interesting. They did a study where they looked at genetic testing and whether it would increase screening behavior in the context of colorectal cancer. And as you guys know better than I do, colorectal cancer is one of the areas where screening is probably beneficial, right?
Yeah.
It did not increase screening behavior, right? So, I mean, just a failure at every level. There have also been studies that have looked at genetic testing coupled with counseling, right? So you're not just giving them the genetic risk information, you're also counseling on them about that information. And the study I'm referring to here was done by Grant, and that their team found that that even when you couple it with counseling, doesn't change your behavior. Really damning evidence over and over and over again. Now, to be fair to the literature, there have been a few studies that have found in very particular situations where, you know, it's like nutrigenomic information, they might change behavior, you know, sodium intake over a short period of time. But the breadth of, you know, the body of evidence suggests that it does not change behavior. And in fact, you know, I always joke that, look, if you bought into that narrative, right, that it changed behavior, then you've got to buy into the whole story, right? You have to buy into the whole story. Genetic risk is probably distributed on a bell curve, right? So there's going to be people that are at increased risk and people that are at decreased risk. So if you believe that genetic risk information changes behavior, you've got to believe that it will also cause people to stop adopting healthy behavior. Do you follow where I'm going with that?
Absolutely. If for some reason you could show that a person had a gene that was associated with not dying or getting cancer from smoking, they may enjoy it so much, it may make them go, well, I'm going to even smoke more, or I might eat this type of food or whatever. So yeah, I mean, you can't have your, so to speak, you can't have your cake and eat it too.
That's right. And in fact, you could argue if you buy the genetic risk changes behavior story, that in the aggregate, it will lead to less healthy behavior, right? Because humans are generally lazy, right? So people are more predisposed to follow that narrative as opposed to the idea that you're supposed to improve your behavior. Yeah. But of course, I don't buy that. And there's evidence to suggest that that you shouldn't buy that. And I think the best systematic review came out not that long ago in BMJ. It was done by the Teresa Martov's group at Cambridge. And they looked at all the available evidence in this regard, and they found, look, the expectation, this is quoting from their abstract, the expectation that communicating DNA-based risk estimates changes behavior is not supported by the existing evidence, right? it's pretty harsh. They go so far as to say that, look, there's just no evidence to support this, and there's really no theoretical reason why it should work, so we should just stop, right? We should stop making this problem.
Please just stop. And I know some people have said, because certainly this is one aspect of it, but there's, you know, there's also been a lot of push to say, well, if we do a genetic, if we knew something about your genetics, we could choose particular medications for you. I mean, and all that sort of stuff. And, you know, to be honest, you know, there's probably two or three medications that I have seen that, in theory, if you knew something about some genetic testing, it would tell you how you metabolized it and so on and so forth. But it hasn't changed much in the last few years. And even if it was three medications, we have probably 5,000 of them. And I know, Mike, I'm sure I can't even think of any indication where it would help you as a GP figure out what medication to use if you knew anything about their genetics.
No, the only ones that I think of are the ones we're doing some genetic stuff to decide on chemotherapy agents.
Yeah, exactly.
That's not at my level at all.
No.
And I'm interested, Tim, one of the things that generally happens when you disprove or like there's a very strong belief system and strong proponents for that belief system, and then research comes out demonstrating that the foundation of that thought is incorrect. Generally, they go through a series of attempts to disprove or discredit that research. Have you seen that occur among the proponents of personalized medicine and genetics?
For sure I have. And look, I want to say that, again, you know, reiterate, I think there's exciting research going on here, right? As you said, with drugs, I think that's also been overblown. But you can certainly see how in the future, you know, genetic information might help inform clinical decisions, right? I'm not trying to, you know, throw everything out here. But with respect to behavior change, for sure, you see that pushback. And the classic pushback, you guys probably even anticipate where this is going. They're going to say, they always go, you know, it's early days, Tim. You know, this is just early days of personalized medicine. We don't have the research to support yet. We'll have to wait and see. Well, it's such a frustrating answer because we had this information and knowledge about behavior change before they even started the endeavor, right? You know, just from other domains, but also even in the context of genetic risk information. And since then, the information just keeps accumulating and accumulating. And even if you know, sort of don't buy that huge sort of conclusion that has come out from the, you know, the systematic reviews in this context, for sure you can't say that that the behavior change justifies the revolutionary language that's used here. You know what I mean? Like, even if there is behavior change, it's tiny. Like, the effect size is tiny. You know, if you look at the literature in the most generous light, right, mm-hmm. It certainly does not justify this massive industry, you know, all this revolutionary language that is associated with genetic testing now.
Yeah. And if you don't have research showing it's a benefit, don't charge for it. You know, don't sell it, because if that's true, then the only context that this information should be used in is under the auspices of a clinical trial, or, you know, or a place where we're actually properly capturing what knowing about this information does. And unfortunately,
that's
it's
your
not
bar you're setting, James.
Pardon me?
If that's the bar you're setting. Like, if you're saying, if you don't have proof that it works, we shouldn't be selling it.
Yeah. Oh, I know.
Almost everything is done.
Yeah. No, I mean, I totally agree with you. And I actually do kind of mean that, realizing that it's a ridiculous comment, because that's never going to happen, because, you know, people can always be sold snake oil and all that sort of stuff. And I know, Tim, you've actually sent off your genes to have people look at what your problems are, right?
That's right.
What your problems are.
I have many, you guys. I have many.
Yes,
and in all seriousness, it was kind of funny when I sent off my sent off saliva in a tube to 23andMe, and I did this years ago. In fact, when it was just starting to get rolling, this phenomenon was still kind of an edgy thing to do. Results that came back were really informative, right? You know, that, you know, I'm at increased risk for colorectal cancer, and I'm increased risk for various kinds of cardiovascular disease. What's the reality here? You know, you're really talking about a very small increased risk in actual, right? In actual terms.
Yeah.
A very small increased risk. And of course, the funny thing is What was their advice to me, their personalized advice to me, right? You guys can probably guess. I'm an increased risk for colorectal cancer. So what is their personalized advice for me? Guess.
Yeah, get screened.
I would guess you should exercise more, a healthy diet, not smoke.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're exactly right.
And find someone to put up with you. That would be...
That's right. And then they had personalized advice for my increased risk in cardiovascular disease. And what was the personalized advice there?
Take a statin. No.
No, it wouldn't be that. It'd be the exact same thing.
Yeah.
You exercise, you don't smoke, you know, you eat lots of fruits and vegetables. And so you don't need a genetic test to get any of that, right? And the other important thing here we should emphasize is there are also concerns about the accuracy of these tests, right? You know, there've been some studies that have shown that there's a huge variation between the companies and the results you get back. And there was a very recent study that found 40% false positive, right? So, you know, the accuracy is also an issue when you get back this information. So you know, when your patients come in with it, you know, that's an important thing to know, right? How accurate is this? And so it's no surprise that Choosing Wisely Canada has suggested that physicians not rely on this information, right? That they should not rely on direct-to-consumer genetic testing information for making clinical decisions, and that they should use more, you know, clinically validated testing methods.
And I think remember when you were presenting at our course, there were people who've actually submitted saliva that doesn't come from humans.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. They someone sent in their dog's DNA. And what was interesting is, you know, some companies said, though, this is unreadable, but some came back with advice, right? About, you know, how you should, you know, you've got great muscle strength.
And recommend it's your toenails you, clip.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, it is absurd. Look, it is a very exciting area of research. There is interesting stuff going on. You know, I can anticipate a world in the future where this information is used for things like transplantation, right? Picking the best, you know, in fact, I'm involved in a research project on that. It involves people at UBC. I could see it helping with decisions around drugs, but it's nowhere near where it's often portrayed in the popular press. Mm-hmm. And certainly in the context of cancer treatment, right? You guys have know more about that than I would. So there is exciting stuff going on, right?
Yeah.
But let's portray it accurately and let's not market bunk to the public.
Yeah. And it's not, other than the sort of small examples that we've talked about, it is just not ready for prime time. Certainly to the degree that, you know, it's being made up for. And I think, you know, when it comes to personalized medicine, I mean, the best way to do it is what, you know, most healthcare providers right now are doing, are, you know, engaging patients in decision making, starting, you know, with low doses of medications, trying to figure out, are you getting side effects and all that sort of different types of treatment. And I mean, whether or not there's any genetics, we should probably all eat a healthy diet. We should all be physically active and we shouldn't smoke. And, you know, that message is being, I'm not sure, how long have you been giving that message, Mike?
I started in medical school in 1992. So,
1992.
whatever that is. Yeah. So 1992. Yeah.
And,
you know, it's interesting is there have been a lot of studies very recently, that have suggested, you know, despite your genes, exercise works, you know, really. You needed to do a study to say that exercise is good for avoiding chronic illness. Yeah, it is a very frustrating time, but I don't think the noise is going away anytime soon, unfortunately.
Yeah, no. Well, great stuff. So, like I said, this is we just thought we'd talk a little bit about this sort of thing because it is, you know, Mike, you and I, and I'm sure we're all in favor of personalized medicine, but an incredibly small subset of personalized medicine is knowing about your genes. And
except for maybe what you're, I would hazard a guess that right now where we are with genetic code, you're better off still taking a good family history. Like, had your father ever had cardiovascular disease? Has your mother ever had cardio? You know what I mean? Like, I think that is probably going to still be more helpful for guiding medical treatment at this stage for the average patient than anything from 23andMe and any of the others. And I don't mean to run down 23andMe, it's just any of these kind of producers. I still think just a simple family history is going to be more helpful.
Yeah, no,
I agree with you. And the interesting thing is, you know, as I said earlier, there are obviously know, genes matter for some diseases in particular, right?
Yeah,
it's interesting, with those diseases, the family history is probably going to be more informative, right? So
do you
know, even for the even for those conditions where genes really matter, do you, how valuable are these direct-to-consumer genetic testing? I think services, you know, that's an open question.
No, for sure. Well, that's great. You know, great stuff, Tim. I really appreciate it. And I love the fact that people like you are sort of delving in this to put a little bit of common sense, or at least put the brakes on it. And not because, like, you're not putting brakes on it because, you know, you're trying to be just a pain in the ass. It's just the evidence is just not there.
You know, that's right. I often get that. Oh, you're such a downer.
Yeah.
I've heard people say I'm anti-science, you know, which is like the furthest thing from the truth. Yeah. Right? The absolute furthest thing from the truth. You know, I want, everyone wants this stuff to work. Everyone wants this stuff to be helpful. Let's just make sure the evidence is there.
Yeah, no, no, for sure. Well, that's great. So thanks. Thanks for coming on the podcast and talking about this issue. And for those of you who are enjoyed listening to this sort of stuff, we're actually going to do another podcast with Tim just a little while, and we'll be talking about another aspect of medicine that is somewhat overblown, and we'll talk about that as we go along. So anything else you want to add, Mike?
Nope, I think you've covered it all.
Yeah, okay, well, thanks as always for listening.
Talk to you later.
Thanks a lot, guys.